dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In my experience with that war, there are a few people who have brought more intelligence to bear and with more profound effect than our first guest. He is Stephen Coughlin, an attorney by training, a man who used his skills as an intelligence officer in the United States Army, particularly serving as a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's Council for understanding the nature of the enemy we were confronting early on after 9/11. He chronicled some of his experiences and those of our country more generally in the years since in an opus that is truly magnum. It is Catastrophic Failure, The Blindfolding of America in the Face of Jihad. I'm very proud to say it, published by the Center for Security Policy Press. He is one of our fellows as well, and a man I admire greatly. Steve Coughlin, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Glad to have you.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
Steve, I thought of you when I came across a piece the other day propounded by a group called the Bridge Initiative, an effort mounted by a truly insidious Muslim Brotherhood front called the Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim Christian Understanding at my alma mater, Georgetown University, which claimed that something called the Explanatory Memorandum has been debunked. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about, first of all, the Explanatory Memorandum and use this meme of it being debunked to explore with us how valid is its characterization of a conspiracy inside the United States to destroy Western civilization from within?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center, which seems to have a lot of Muslim Brotherhood presence, is funded by Prince Al-Walid bin Talal of Saudi Arabia. And that raises the question of it being a foreign influence campaign. We can also go to a year earlier where David Shipper wrote a book where he started raising this issue. I think that the explanatory memorandum, which we will get to momentarily, has been so devastatingly effective that they're just deciding they're going to engage in an overt act of disinformation. The explanatory memorandum is a document that was seized in a raid by the FBI in 2004 of a Muslim Brotherhood operative where they found this document. The FBI or the Justice Department translated it into English because it was written in Arabic, and it was the Brotherhood's master plan for how they were going to engage the United States in their operational planning. And they wrote this in 1991. The author was a man named Muhammad Akram. So one of the first things I like to say is, well, this was just some itinerant guy. He was not. He was the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood at the time. And one of the things I pointed out in my book, and I went into detail because we could see that they were starting to challenge the efficacy of this document. So we showed all the things that were going on around about the time this was written to show that there were conferences within a month of him writing this document that fed right into the very things that this document spoke to that were held at places like the IIIT in Herndon, Virginia. So we know.
That's the International Institute for Islamic Thought, which is prominently featured as a Muslim Brotherhood front, among other things, in this list that Muhammad Akram attached to the explanatory memorandum. Steve, this is really important because we're told by this Bridge Initiative, among others, that, not only was this guy a nobody, but also that there really wasn't any evidence that this kind of a plan, if you will, was embraced by anybody else in the Brotherhood or otherwise, and specifically that they have done this textual analysis that suggests that words like civilization, jihad, have never been used otherwise. And in short, that this is perhaps one man's wishful thinking, but not something that actually bears on what the Brotherhood is up to in this country. How would you respond?
Well, I just think this is another example. You can make the argument, maybe, that the Justice Department that translated it was not artful in their translation, but nobody seriously challenges. I don't think there's any doubt. Let's back up a second. This document was admitted into evidence in the Holy Land Foundation case. The other side, the defense, protested this document vociferously because the judge said that it was one of the main documents that led to their conviction. They went to appeal. The appellate court upheld it. They tried to take it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, no, we're not taking the case. This document is the reason they were prosecuted. It has held up an appeal. And the idea that has been debunked is fraudulent.
Yeah, this is really important because one of the things that the Bridge Initiative says is the judge actually said in the course of that trial that this was not relevant to the conviction. Your recollection of it is obviously 180 degrees different. Is that an example of disinformation?
I would not say it's my recollection. I would say we can read it right. He stated that in the appeal. In his opinion order, he said that document was decisive. And so we know that that's what led to the conviction. There's 0% ambiguity. And I think it's really important because we go back to it. They will then say, well, look, they're just saying he's a secretary, like maybe he was somebody taking the minutes of the meeting. And then you have to go and show, no, they mean secretary like secretary general. And in fact, someone running the minutes of the meeting as opposed to the person who was in charge. But then again, one of the things I pointed out in my book is you see all these books around that period being written, and this is completely in tune with that. And as important, that there was a conference like 2 weeks after the explanatory memorandum was written where he was a named speaker, where the title of his presentations were in line with that document. And of course, in the explanatory memorandum, he goes on and says that this is the document of the Muslim Brotherhood. It follows off of meetings that were held by the Shura Council in 1987. And it's also a logical progression from a document called The Project that the FBI had the Swiss seize in Switzerland, in Lugano, Switzerland, that was written in, I think, 1982, that laid out the broad strokes of how they were going to do this.
Yeah. So this plan has a pedigree, in other words. Again, our guest is Stephen Coughlin. Your book, Catastrophic Failure, drills down on this chapter 3 in considerable detail, and I commend it to everyone. As I do the explanatory memorandum itself, and that's available for free as a PDF at our website, securefreedom.org. And it's very important reading. It's a short tract, but boy, it sure lays it out. And that's why I think you're so right in contesting as disinformation what those who are trying to poo-poo this document or otherwise dismiss its implications is so important, Stephen. And is it fair to say that what this document was, it was never meant for our eyes, let's be clear. This was meant as a report back to the mothership in Egypt to describe the progress that had been made in the first 25 years or so of the Brotherhood's efforts to engage in this civilization jihad in the United States. Is that correct? And if so, it really maps out not only what's been accomplished, but what they were hoping to accomplish in the, well, now 26 or 7 years since.
Well, I think there's no question but that's true. I mean, that document fits perfectly into everything we know about how the Brotherhood operates. And the point of it is it was captured in a raid of someone known to be a Muslim Brotherhood operative. I mean, I think we're spending a lot of time trying to explain what is actually so simple. It takes a lot of work. The reality of it is so simple. We captured their archive. And even if you threw out the explanatory memorandum, there were boxes and boxes of documents that could have been brought in to reconfirm that exact picture 100 times over.
Yeah. And Steve, this just in closing very quickly, I've long hoped that we would see those other box's contents. And it seems to me that would be a very important initiative of the Trump administration to make those materials available perhaps on a crowdsourced basis so that we could really examine quickly what else is to be known about the Brotherhood and why they should be designated, in my judgment, as a terrorist organization. Steve Coughlin, we are hard out of time. There's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon and allow us to do so. And next up, we'll be joined by Diana West. We'll talk about whether there's precedent for the kind of penetration and subversion from within that the Brotherhood is up to now. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Our guest at this hour each week, I'm very privileged to say, is Diana West, the longtime syndicated columnist who now blogs with great effect at dianawest.net. She is the author of two best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can also find her writings in outlets like the Daily Caller these days, and it's always a pleasure to have her with us. Diana, good to have you. Welcome back.
Wonderful to be with you.
Well, we've just been talking with our friend and colleague Stephen Coughlin about a phenomenon that has, I believe, accurately been described in this explanatory memorandum of the Muslim Brotherhood, dated 1991. There is, as you know, Diana, a considerable effort to, as they say, debunk that tract and its relevance to the challenges that we're facing. And I wanted, you know, to tie in some of your insights, particularly with what happened to this country and others during the heyday of Soviet communism, and arguably is still being afflicted by the effects of its legacy. Namely, is there really a reason to be concerned about conspiracies that operate to penetrate and subvert our civil society and other institutions from within?
Oh, the easy answer is yes, in spades. The real concern, though, I think at this stage is how dead we are to the concept, how insensate we've become to the whole suggestion. The reflex is to laugh, to scoff, and to turn around and point fingers at the person who might be bringing up extremely important, weighty evidence. And indeed, this again is kind of a mechanism that sent me into the writing of American Betrayal, which is an excursion through the suppression of conspiracies, of malign actors seeking to overturn our constitution and way of life in those days coming out of the communist movement, the Communist Party, Soviet KGB, etc.
Our guest is Diana West. You can find her collected works at dianawest.net. And you were making the very important point about our historical experience and its relevance to the future. Talk about that.
Well, I think the lesson that I would draw is not only that this kind of intelligence war waged by the Soviet Union against our country covertly through the placement of Soviet agents and assets into our government and related institutions. We have a documented over 500 of these agents and assets, according to the scholarship, but there are many, many more. It's not simply that they existed, but you have to look at the record of the United States government in suppressing their existence. And this would be an executive branch effort. Certainly, we see from Roosevelt to Truman to Eisenhower and forward, there's always the effort to suppress these kinds of revelations. And I think what's also important is to understand the long arc of this attempted subversion of this country in terms of the explanatory memorandum. And what I mean by that is in terms of people with guides, how-to guides, really, and densely detailed explanations and orders about how to infiltrate. And this will go back to, there was a very famous raid I only learned about in recent times, in the last year or so, in 1922, where Fed, state, and local raided a communist conclave in Michigan and were able to cart away barrels. In those days, we didn't have thumb drives and things like that, barrels of documents coming out of the Soviet Union being disseminated by communist networks in the United States that essentially laid out how to infiltrate everything from the local women's club, you know, trying to raise money for relief efforts in to relieve famine in Moscow, et cetera, in Russia, to the government. So this kind of thing has been going on forever, and or at least 100 years.
How has that practice under the communists informed what the civilization jihadists, to use the term in the explanatory memorandum, are doing in America and elsewhere today?
I think that the lesson there and what we can see carried forward is the use of front group. And people don't really understand what a front group is or how it functions. You'll say, oh, well, there are only a few Muslim Brotherhood people in this entity, or there are only a few communists in this entity. It's filled with all kinds of respectable and important and wonderful people as well. So how can you even be talking about this? But that betrays an ignorance of how the front group works. A very small group, it can be as few as one, two, or three, learns how to take over the direction of a group, learns how to use Trojan horse style, the front, to maneuver, to hide, and to influence policymaking. You
know, we see this particularly in operations like the Interfaith Dialogue Movement, don't we?
Absolutely.
Let me turn to a different topic, if I can, quickly, Diana, because we're going to run out of time, but it's directly related, of course. We're watching, as we speak, the electoral process in the Netherlands taking place. Geert Wilders is making a strong run for the leadership of his country. It may not be sufficient to actually secure the government role that he has sought, but nonetheless, it will be evidence of, I think, the sentiment of his people if he performs well, and that seems likely. Talk a little bit about what's going on in the Netherlands at the moment. What's the wellspring of support for Wilders' party, and where you think this is likely to lead, however the outcome turns out?
Well, it is a watershed moment, truly, in the history of not just the Netherlands, but really the Western world. This is a moment where Geert Wilders does stand poised to seize, if not the reins of power, a large part of power. And it comes out of decades of mass immigration, so much of it from the Islamic world, the Third World certainly, and also mass European Union, which has effectively sucked out so much of Dutch wealth and sovereignty to the unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats in Brussels. And these are really the two pegs of his appeal and what have powered him through his whole career. And he is at this point of possible power. And as we've seen him come to this point, we see all kinds of new ramping up efforts against him. We saw the security breaches that were very terrifying earlier last month and so on, but we've also seen him very recently. We've seen rioting by the massive Turkish population of Amsterdam and an absolute crisis between the Netherlands and Turkey, which essentially all the good things that the Dutch government have done in terms of standing up to this effort to coerce the election in the Netherlands by the Turkish government is in reaction to Geert Wilders' strong run and political point of view. I mean, it's really the only backbone the Dutch government has is really by transference from Wilders. So
an implant.
This is
Let me ask you, Diana, when you talk about the Turks' role, it's my understanding that they've been principally focused on trying to get Turkish voters to vote in an election, in fact, a referendum in Turkey to help Erdogan consolidate his power there. Are you suggesting that, in fact, this is as much about trying to influence the election in the Netherlands as well?
I think so. I mean, that's my own. That's one gal's opinion. Mm-hmm. I think so as well. I think it's an effort to mobilize the Turkish Dutch, you know, dual nationals who can vote in Holland to vote against Wilders. I think that would certainly be what I would be doing if I was looking at it out of Turkey. This is something that is not unusual. We've seen Erdogan visit Germany, for example, and rally the Turks against any kind of assimilation, which again would be a very political and overt, you know, hostile effort. effort inside a sovereign nation. So we see this kind of thing. And of course, one of Geert Wilders' points is you can't really be a dual national anymore. You've got to choose. You've got to choose one or the other. And I think this is part of another piece of why it's coming to a head.
Especially
people want it both ways.
When the common denominator is trying to impose Sharia supremacism, really, on a country like the Netherlands, which Geert Wilders, of course, standing very robustly against. I wish him well. I think you do, too, Diana.
I wish you
well as well. Also, thanks so much for joining us today. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we will be speaking with Jim Hansen. We'll take stock with him about the visit of the Saudi Deputy Crown Prince to Washington, North Korea, and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for a visit with the frequent guest host of this program and my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Executive Vice President, Jim Hansen. Jim is, of course, a man of many parts, but not least he brings to our conversations what I think of as the boots on the ground perspective on national security, having served with great distinction as a Green Beret in the United States Army. Jim, welcome. It's good to have you as always.
Always a pleasure, Frank.
So let's start with this meeting that the president had yesterday with the deputy crown prince of Saudi Arabia. He is Mohammed bin Salman, a man widely described as a young comer in the Saudi royal family. And his operatives put out the word that the meeting constituted an historic turning point in U.S.-Saudi relations and perhaps for the region more generally. What did you make of the meeting? What do we know of what happened there? And what would be historically turning about it?
I think it's a fair assessment or a fair showing of the fact that the Saudis have a pretty good PR firm. You know, whoever they're paying for that, that's a smart way to walk out of it, no matter what the actual substance of the meeting is. Declare victory, say, you know, the world's going to be a better place. The Saudis are our worst frenemy and have been for a long time. You know, they contend with the Iranians for the title and largest sponsor of state terrorism worldwide. They created a lot of the madrasas and schools that teach extreme, Islam around the world. They are essentially the creators and now our partners in stopping terrorism. So the only reason they get a pass historically has been oil. You know, we have had to deal with them because they are a major force in OPEC. They, you know, produce a lot of the world's oil. Consequently, their influence was important to us. I think we're at a point now where the Bakken oil fields and other things may allow us to rethink that. But I don't think we've gotten to the point where we can say we're actually in any way, shape or form can trust or be friends with these guys.
That's so much there to chew on. The principal point, I think, is that if there is, in fact, to be a significant, let alone historic change in this relationship, Jim Hansen, it seems it mustn't simply be that the president is rebalancing away from the lunatic approach that Barack Obama took of embracing and empowering and enriching the Iranians, our mutual enemy, the Saudis and ours, but also that the Saudis have to stop this double game, specifically the efforts that they've been making to support the people we've been talking about with Steve Coughlin and Diana West earlier in the program, the Muslim Brotherhood and this infrastructure of mosques and front groups and Islamic societies and the like that are being used to subvert us from within, don't you think?
I think the Saudis, like I said, they were – it's tough to say whether they or the Iranians actually deserve the title. But they have spread, you know, the supremacist ideology with all the oil money. You know, that was the huge advantage they had was the revenue from that oil money and the rest of it gave them the ability to push that supremacism all around, to build an infrastructure around the world, including here, that preaches that. And also, you know, I mentioned they have a good PR firm coming out of this meeting with the president, but they've had an entire propaganda campaign going on for decades to to say that, you know, oh, this isn't a problem, nothing to see here, move along. You know, and they've got so many people, Obama among them, who have become apologists, you know, for that supremacism and say, no, that's not actually what they mean. I know that's what they said, but that's not what actually what they mean. And it's absurd to watch, but you're absolutely right. They need to change that, or they are as much of a problem, and in essence, nothing has actually changed.
Yeah, it makes the emphasis on enemies in frenemies rather than friends. And one of the pieces of it, of course, that is afflicting not just us but others as well is sort of the Saudis' encouragement of the Brotherhood and the hijra by refugees around the world and the construction of these mosques to sort of help inseminate in those populations, including in Western societies, very much the sort of Wahhabist Sharia supremacism for which they're renowned. Let me pivot. There's a lot of talk about pivots when it comes to Asia, Jim, but you've spent a lot of time out there in your former incarnation in the Green Beret, including thinking through how do we defend our friends in South Korea. I wanted to visit with you. Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, is, of course, out there at the moment and holding meetings in which the threat from the North is very much topic A. What's your view of the implications of the political instability in South Korea and what it might mean for our ability to help defend that country, our allies and our assets and personnel there, of course, first and foremost?
You know, we've been watching as a succession of Kims have been the supreme leader in North Korea. And I've been watching personally, wondering which one was actually going to snap. You know, they've all been various flavors of crazy. They've all, presided over one of the most horrific death camps on an ongoing basis, not in the sheer numbers. Obviously, the Communist Chinese and the Soviets crush them in sheer numbers, but just in percentage of their population that they've just destroyed and forced into horrific conditions.
Yeah, it's so, one big gulag, I think, the country.
Yeah, they've got their entire country as a gulag, and they use the people to create their only product, which is, you know, machines of war. They build nuclear weapons now. They built hundreds and thousands and, you know, just a massive army that they can't support. And so we watch now to see, all right, when is it going to actually tip? You know, the Chinese have kept them going. And to some extent, we occasionally pipe in and give them cash and prizes for stopping their craziness. But at some point, and I think this Kim is the best candidate for it, one of these guys is going to snap and go too far, and we're going to end up in that war. And obviously, you mentioned, you know, we've got exercises going on now. We do them every year. You know, I participate in them a number of times, the ones that are upcoming, Full Legal and the others. And we practice and we make sure that we're coordinated with the South Koreans in case they go crazy and come across the border. I think at this point, it's the nuclear option that makes me more nervous, you know, or the ballistic missile option that they may end up actually hitting a target as opposed to just lobbing the missiles into the ocean.
Yeah, well, there's some evidence that we may have contributed to them not being able to hit targets, but that presumably is at an end. And Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, one of our colleagues, has got a terrific piece in the Washington Times today talking about the progress that the North Koreans, among others, are making in these missile threats. Jim, just quickly on the question of the likely leftward tilt of the new government of South Korea. Do you think if we wind up getting them back in the business of this so-called sunshine policy, detente with the North, that our security interests as well as theirs will once again be severely degraded?
It's definitely a danger. I mean, the problem with appeasement of tyrants is the tyrants are never appeased. You know, it feeds their appetite. It's the lifelong struggle that you cannot change a predator into someone you can coexist with. And North Korea is like that rabid dog, you know, with more than a couple extra illnesses as well, completely dangerous. And you cannot invite that in. You cannot make friends with it. You simply have to contain it. And at some point, regime change is the actual answer up there. But that's a complicated piece.
It's a hard piece in this particular part of the world, as you've studied closely and helped, I think through for our military in your previous capacity, Jim Hansen. Thank you very much for the job you're doing these days at the Center for Security Policy. I'd hope to get into the scandal now apparently afflicting the Marine Corps and the Navy with various I think it's the predictable result of the social engineering that's been taking place there under the Obama administration particularly, but that's for another day. We'll look forward to talking with you as soon as we can. Jim, again, we thank you so much for your service to our country in uniform, Jim, and look forward to talking with you again very soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Russ Dallin. We'll be talking with him about the latest developments in Venezuela and what they might mean for all of us. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Russ Dallin, the president and editor-in-chief at the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is, by training and trade, a investment guru in the financial sphere. He's also a man that we turn to with regularity for insights into what is happening in Latin America, and privileged to be able to do so today. Russ, welcome back. Good to have you, sir.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. It's always always a pleasure and a learning experience to be with you.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and vice versa. Let me ask you about something I've just learned about, actually, on your pages of the Latin American Herald Tribune, and that is that the Organization of American States Secretary General, a man who has been best known until recently as an unalloyed leftist, I believe, has nonetheless come down rather hard on the regime of Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela. Tell us a little bit about what's happening there and what you think might come of it.
Well, you're absolutely right. Frank, it is a development that the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, the OAS, has been pursuing and basically is updating a report he gave to the OAS Assembly, made up of all the Latin American nations of the Caribbean and South America, recommending that Venezuela be suspended from the organization for violating the Democratic Charter. This is by far, it's a 73-page indictment with over 210 footnotes in it, including one quoting me. I'm
wow.
Pleased to be able to say. building a case almost like a lawyer for what has happened in Venezuela in terms of the corruption, the dictatorial stance, the poverty, the starvation, the violation of the Constitution, the violation of the rule of law, and basically recommending to the OAS General Assembly, which it has to be voted on, that they go ahead and suspend Venezuela for violating of the Democratic Charter unless Venezuela holds free and fair elections within 30 days, frees all its political prisoners, and recognizes the National Assembly that was elected by the people to try and get out of this mess and giving an overwhelming supermajority to the opposition, and puts in a new electoral board and new Supreme Court. Unlikely those things are going to happen.
Yeah, no, but
it's an amazing thing.
Even that OAS is asking for it. It's the kind of thing that, you know, you would have thought perhaps a robust American government would be requiring of the Venezuelans. That certainly wasn't true under the previous government, and I don't think has been anything the new Trump administration has called for either. But this is very heartening, I have to say. And you've been following this very closely. You've lived in Venezuela for many years both a banker and as a newspaper man. But when you look at this, Russ Dallin, I wonder whether the magnitude of this indictment is in part a function, at least, of the instructions that we learn from your reporting have been given by Fidel Castro before his death, of course, to both Hugo Chavez, the previous president of Venezuela, and his present successor, the Nicolas Maduro. What has been the role of that sort of totalitarian, you know, sort of inspiration in bringing Venezuela to its present pass?
It's almost been single-handedly responsible for bringing the world's oil-rich nation to the brink of bankruptcy, and it's proof that even if communism or Cuban communism and its communist variant were planted in the richest nation in the world, they could still bankrupt it. Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, handpicked successor to Hugo Chavez, admitted the other day that he received frequent instructions from Fidel, and indeed went there every 2 weeks, every second weekend, basically, for the last 4 years to receive instructions from Fidel. So this can't get any more clear.
This is a very direct feed and controlling influence. And I guess in part what reinforces it is the fact that the regime in Venezuela has been very dependent, as I understand it, on Cuban, you know, mercenaries or secret services or what have you to maintain control. Is that still the case? And if so, presumably it is a way of ensuring that those instructions will be followed faithfully.
Yes, I'm afraid it is. Throughout, the Cubans are renowned for a few things that they're able to do, and one of them is spy on each other. And that's how you, obviously, an expertise that you learn to keep your neighbors in line so that no one takes out Fidel or the Castro brothers. And they were able to export that expertise or their practitioners of that expertise to Venezuela. Indeed, there are Cubans all throughout the Venezuelan military reporting back and even wearing the Venezuelan uniform. And informing on their fellow soldiers in case there ever was a coup d'etat or attempt brewing to try and get Venezuela out of the dictatorship that it is in, and that is indeed what, by the way, the OAS report, which reads more like an indictment, a lawyerly indictment. Indeed, by the way, the Secretary General of the OAS, Luis Almagro, while being the leftist, former leftist foreign minister, is indeed a lawyer, and it is written like a lawyer's indictment.
A brief, yeah.
Of that situation.
Well, this is important, and hopefully it will conduce to change within Venezuela. But among the changes that are going to have to happen there for really anything remotely like a restoration of its prosperity, presumably, is getting the dead hand of the communist regime off of the economy. And I was struck to realize that to learn the other day that the government owns something like 500 businesses, a wildly larger percentage of them than other much bigger countries like Brazil and Argentina, for example. What are the implications of that, Russ Dahlin, as an economist and financier, for the state of the economy of Venezuela and its future prospects?
Dismal. This again goes back to Cuban instructions. In Cuba, of course, all businesses are pretty much owned by the state. Venezuela is following in those illustrious footsteps. Everything from bicycles, coffee, medicine, cell phones, aerospace components, petroleum, milk, hotels. Everything is pretty much owned by the state. It didn't start out that way. They didn't start many of those businesses, but they expropriated them or nationalized them and took them away. And all that's left is debt and destruction in its waste, because well, we've all been to the Driver's License Bureau. Mm-hmm. Government is not good at those.
I pray that all of these young people in America who are so admiring of Bernie Sanders and his desire to take our country in a similar direction will study up on Venezuela, as you say, the plight of this country and its people with all that they had going for it at the hands of the socialists and communists and worse is almost beyond imagination and deeply, deeply troubling, both for the folks involved. Involved, of course, but also, I believe, as a security threat to this country. Rust Allen, it's always great to have a chance to visit with you about this part of your portfolio there at the Latin American Herald Tribune, and appreciate the chance to visit with you and learn from you about your work also at Caracas Capital Markets. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.